Hi, welcome. Thanks for coming to the launch and panel discussion of Public Trust in Expert Knowledge Symposium. So my name is Silvia Camporese. I'm a lecturer here at King's. Many of you know me. I'm delighted to have this wonderful panelist. I have here Professor Deborah Baumann, Professor of Ethics and Law at St. George's Medical School, University of London. And also was recently awarded with an MBE. I have to say that's congratulations. And we are delighted. Deborah is one of the contributors of the special issue. You have a little leaflets that tell you about the table of content. And then I have my lovely co-editors, Maria Vaccarella, lecturer in Medical Humanities, University of Bristol. Used to be at King's, but lost it to Bristol. Professor Mark Davis, professor of sociology at Monash University, who used to be here on a visiting fellowship and also a co-editors of this special issue. So I'm going to keep it brief and just tell you how this special issue came into being, and then I'll leave you to my co-panelists. So what happened is in 2015, Maria and I applied for a little bit of funding from the KIS DTC, the Doctoral Training Center, for some money at the crossroads between arts and humanities, that was Maria, and social sciences. That was me, because I'm based in the Department of Global Health and Social Medicine. And we decided to bring together our interests in bioethics and narrative medicine. And we had this doctoral training course, intensive 1 week, open to all kind of doctoral students from any discipline, from King's or UCL, University of London. And it happened that Mark Davis was a visiting professor at the time in our department and decided to come along. So we started talking about our shared interest in narrative approaches to question of ethics, health, and society. Mark is a sociologist. Maria is a medical humanities scholar, and I'm a bioethicist with an interdisciplinary background in biotechnology, philosophy, and now ended up in a social sciences department. So, Mark was so nice that he said, do you want to come to Melbourne to do to a repeat of the doctoral training course, and maybe we can do something around it, get some funds to do that. So Mark is very good at getting funds, and he had us travel to Monash last May, and we did the doctoral training course for Monash students, but we also put in a bid to have a special issue, the special issue with the Journal of Bioethical Inquiry, and we decided to focus on trust as a topic for our work. I'm just going to read from our article, because it's written in a better way that I can just say it. So we decided to settle on public trust as a topic for our work together, because its problematization cuts across our fields and substantive research interest. Trust in expert biomedical knowledge, willingness to believe, endorse, and enact expert advice has emerged as an ethical, epistemological, and political problem for governments seeking to engage and influence publics on matters as wide ranging as public policy on the environment, economic development, biopolitics, well-being over their life course. And it was apparent to us that there is considerable flux in the trust invested in health experts, in their formation, and the emerging technologies and science on which their authority is in part based. So we had this call for papers for around the topic of public trust in expert knowledge, narrative, ethics, and engagement. That was the title of the call for paper. But we didn't say, you know, we want paper on vaccination or on climate change or on antimicrobial resistance. We just said we want papers that adopt a narrative methodology to question of public trust in expert knowledge and be specific about the kind of methodologies that you use in your paper. And we try to be interdisciplinary and cross the bridge between social science, philosophy, medical humanities, and narrative. So we had quite a few applications. Some were from topics that we expected, like vaccination or climate change, and some from topics that we didn't expect. For example, the paper from Deborah Bama on trust less explored in relation to the ways in which understanding of and responses to questions of ethics are discussed by both the public and the experts. So public engagement activity in healthcare ethics and the questions that you raise is related to trust in analyzing a moral problem. As you can see, so there are six contributions, this special issue. All the papers are now published online, so you can access them ahead of print. We do have a paper on vaccination, we made it to the final cut, but we had two paper submission earlier on climate change, but didn't make it in the end in the special issue. But we have a paper on chronic pain and epistemic injustice, so about, you know, the power hierarchies between in medicine, between healthcare providers and patients, and the kind of systematic discrediting of certain type of people, in this case, patients with chronic pain, from being producers of knowledge. This is Daniel Buchman, Anita Ho, and Daniel Goldberg. So these are American from the US, Singapore, and Canada, a collaboration. And then we have another paper that talks about epistemic injustice in the case of gestational diabetes. These are also is more kind of paper in the medical humanities scholarship from Jennifer Edwell and Jordan Jack. And we have a paper from Karen Ann Wong talking about donor conception and passing, why Australian parents of donor conceived children want donors to look like them. And I'm not going to talk about the paper by Deborah because Deborah can talk about it. But I think also I have to thank some of the reviewers for the special issue and in this room. So thank you. But it was my first time working as a guest editor, and I found like, oh, it's so difficult to find reviewers. So thank you for, you know, agreeing. You can review it, and if you don't, I'm just going to knock on your door because I know where you are. So I think I'll... stop it here. I'm going to leave it. I thought we could do it. Mark and Maria to talk about also their editorial work in this special issue and their interest in public trust in expert knowledge. Then Dulcis Infmundo, I don't know how you say in English, but at the end, at the best, we'll have Deborah talking about their contribution. And then we have plenty of time for questions because we don't have to leave here until 7:30. So. Yes, so there you go. So I'm going to leave it to Mark. I don't know.
So I actually need to forward my PowerPoint. I need to be over there.
You need to be over there? Do you want me to forward it for you?
No, no, it's okay.
Can I just say, in the meantime, the reason I'm going to start with these are kind of like me, so if you want to follow and engage, the hashtag is #LarryTrust.
Okay. Thank you very much for that introduction. I thought that what I should do is perhaps talk a little bit about narrative and how it might have implications for how we think about ethics and public engagement, in case you were wondering, and explain a little bit about the genealogy. So this sort of happy accident of meeting Maria and Sylvia Atkins while I was here, when I was trying to conceptualize a project around antimicrobial resistance and how to engage publics, and also thinking, finishing a book manuscript on pandemic influenza and the same problem. How do we explain to publics what's happening in terms of H1N1 and the kind of empirical material I had when it was apparent that many people use storytelling to explain their experiences. And then looking more closely at public communications and public policy, the significance of narrative in what was going on there. So happily, the Australian Research Council has agreed actually to fund me and colleagues to look at public communications around antimicrobial resistance. So I owe some kind of debt to the encouragement of Sylvia and Maria at King's in 2015. So thank you very much. And to get you thinking about narrative and antimicrobial resistance, you can't really go past this. And let me read it. The time may come when penicillin can be bought by anyone in the shops. Remarkable, isn't it? Then there is the danger that the ignorant man may easily underdose himself, and by exposing his microbes to non-lethal quantities of the drug, make them resistant. Here is a hypothetical illustration. Mr. X has a sore throat. I think I might be Mr. X today, actually. He buys some penicillin and gives himself not enough to kill the streptococci, but enough to educate them to resist penicillin. He then infects his wife. Mrs. X gets pneumonia and is treated with penicillin. As the streptococci are now resistant to penicillin, the treatment fails. Mr. X dies. Who is primarily responsible for Mr. X's death? Why, Mr. X, whose negligent use of penicillin changed the nature of the microbe. So this is old-style medical paternalism from the 40s, and we can all see that. But what it does teach us is how powerful storytelling is, the kind of explanation of cause and effect, the characters that populate this story, and its moral tone, its kind of organisation of responsibility. These are the kinds of qualities of narrative that kind of we can detect across public communications in the field. And that's kind of why I'm interested in narrative. What are these cultural structures that we're using to explain to publics what's going on in the microbial world? We come to more recent times. You know, Fleming's prophecy has come true. Superbugs are there and doing horrible things to people. And we're telling stories about that in the news in the kind of most banal sense. So what's going on in the news media? How are they telling their stories? And what does that mean about the public consciousness around antimicrobial resistance? And this is important because we want to engage publics, not just us, but everybody is implicated in the crisis. So the O'Neill Report, amongst the many things it has said needs to happen for an effective global response to the pandemic, to the AMR kind of problem, is public communications. So, you know, well-funded, properly organised, persuasive stories about what publics need to do and not do in relation to antibiotics and other failing pharmaceuticals. So implied here is a use of narrative to engage, to explain science and engage. And I'm interested in what's going on here. And we've all come across, we are likely to have come across the concept of narrative medicine. So when I'm thinking about what narrative is doing in AMR communications, I turn to the kind of tradition of narrative medicine and how narrative has been conceptualized as its role in kind of medical practices. So Trish Greenhalgh has talked about narrative medicine as the way to socialize and humanize the way medicine is done, and Kleinman and so on have done that as well. So it's interesting that there's a kind of tradition of the use of narrative to transform medicine and how it's practiced, to think about the relationship between the doctor and the patient. The kind of idea, Trish Greenhalgh's idea, that to listen to the story told by the patient enhances one's ability to diagnose, to make treatment recommendations, to organise care. So there's this kind of humanistic tranche of uses of narrative in and around biomedicine. And Kleinman pointing very deliberately to the art and ethics of narrative medicine, that medicine is not just the technical exercise of transmitting knowledge and encouraging and persuading, but actually healing and all of the kind of complexities that are around there. And I think for our special issue, this is where there's a contact point with Edwell and Jack when they talk about women with gestational diabetes and the kind of lack of trust that circulates in and around their management of their diabetes and their pregnancy, and how those women are pitched into a quest for a way of explaining, a way of narrating this kind of in-betweenness of their diagnosis with gestational diabetes. So it's a classic use of Arthur Frank's ideas about quest, chaos, and restitution kind of emerging in that journal article. But we're also seeing across this field of AMR this idea that narrative can persuade. So we have this idea of narrative persuasion, where in my field, in Superbugs, in America, the Pew Trust funding a kind of super mums against superbugs and using personal stories of mums to explain what they're doing in relation to the superbugs crisis. And another kind of area in narrative is this idea of the kind of neurology of narrative. So people are actually experimenting with brain imaging and narrative exposure and thinking about what the narrative is doing to people's brains. So there's a turn here in public health to narrative. We've got Fleming using stories to explain his perspectives. We've got O'Neill saying we need to tell stories effectively to influence what publics are thinking about AMR. We've got narrative medicine, and now we've got the narrative persuasion kind of concept coming in as well. But it's more complicated than that. So Atwell, in our special issue, talks about vaccine-rejecting parents, and she and her colleagues interviewed them about their perspectives. So vaccine rejectors are normally typified as like rejecting science and being anti-science. But what Atwell shows is actually it's more complicated. Of course it's more complicated. And that the nuances in how people rationalise their rejection of vaccination is tied in with, trust in big pharma, not so much science, but what the pharmaceutical industries and their involvement in the vaccine industry. So that it's important to kind of, have a sense of how people are actually talking about what's going on for them in a more complicated way. And if we look at what's happening in media, I don't know about you, but I'm quite struck with the kind of complexity. It's not a simple us and them or a kind of vaxxer, anti-vaxxer. There's not a kind of binary division here. There's all sorts of storytelling happening across social media. So on the far left, this is the kind of example of a formal communication about the benefits of vaccination and how to use it. In the middle, we have a website which is called Sane Vac Inc. And it's actually not that sane. It's the anti-vaxxer website. And they use stories to explain why one shouldn't vaccinate. So it's a kind of dissident storytelling around vaccination. And then there's this, which I don't think is overly helpful. So this is the Shame Twitter feed. And I don't know who it is. I'd like to interview them. But they're shaming the anti-vaxxers. So they're finding what these people are saying and putting it up and pushing a message about how insane the anti-vaxxers are. So how do we conceptualise these kind of competing stories that are happening in social media? Obviously, social media is transforming how we tell stories, what's possible to say, and the kind of complex agonism that's happening around the science of vaccination. And I think slamming anti-vaxxers is not going to, in a public health view, is not going to get us very far, I'm not sure. So those are the kinds of concepts that I think are important in narrative. There's a little glimpse into the kind of richness of narrative as a way of thinking about how we communicate about science and how it intersects with AMR, but also the kind of other concerns that we raised in our special issue. Thank you very much. No worries.
Thank you. So I don't have slides because I'm not a social scientist. joking aside, I've mentioned this quite often in my collaboration with Sylvia and Mark that I was a bit like the odd figure in it because, of course, I come from a literary background. I don't work on policy and the methodology you know, of social sciences and bioethics, to me, looks more similar than what I usually do with my books and my students, sometimes medical students, but very often humanities students. So it was a challenge. It was exciting to be part of, first of all, the doctoral program I did with Sylvia in narrative bioethics, and then the series of events we ran at Monash, and finally this journal issue. I must admit I was a bit scared because I thought it's going to be very difficult for medical humanists to contribute, like, you know, to, you know, propose a paper for a bioethics journal. But we ended up with at least two, actually, medical humanities contributions. So I'm really happy for, first of all, the openness of people in my field. But then also, there's something broader here happening. It is one of the latest articles published in your journal, Deborah, which is all about the overlap between narrative bioethics and the medical humanities. The authors of the paper actually conceptualize, maybe flag up a certain humanistic turn in bioethics, which is very interesting because I thought, you know, narrative was big enough, but humanistic is even bigger. And I mean, once again, like just trying to join forces rather than protect our own little sub areas. As Sylvia was going through the various topics that have appeared in our special issue, I mean, of course, some of them are constructed, like, you know, within a medical humanities framework, like, for example, Deborah's work on public engagement. But then I was thinking about vaccination, and by chance, like this morning, I gave my seminar to my students, English students, and we discussed this letter from the 18th century, this woman, Lady Montagu, who traveled to Turkey with her husband. You might have bumped into this. And she saw the people in Turkey were inoculating the smallpox, you know, for immunization. And of course, she was amazed, and, you know, smallpox was very severe at the time. And there's all this in the space of a private, you know, medium, like a letter sent to a friend, there was quite a big call for, you know, a change in policy, a change in medical practice. And we discussed this with my students while looking at how this was constructed, how she, as a woman, first of all, could make a claim. She's very aware of her position as, well, a woman, first of all, not a medical doctor, and how could she persuade the doctors in England to adopt this technique or just to give it a try? As I told my students, I mean, she ended up doing, she ended up playing a bit with her very normative gender role at the time, and she had her son vaccinated. Oh, I mean, vaccinated is a big word here, but anyway. She tried this technique on her son, so, you know, just playing on the caring mother, maybe stereotype, to validate this innovation in public health, really. So once again, you see the overlap between bioethics, discussions around ethical issues, and the contribution that, in this case, life writing or sometimes fictional writing can give, as what we usually say in the medical humanities, a sort of safe space to experiment a bit, to think a bit more around issues, and then maybe feed into policy and the other debates. I've heard that sometimes, you know, one of the critiques of bioethics is that the more complex the issue, the drier the conversation becomes. So, of course, medical humanities can help maybe nuance in all these conversations a bit more. And then, of course, with the issue of trust, in the humanities, I think we are going through a similar process. So all this skepticism and all this awareness of the senses among experts, of course, results in a different way of approaching literary texts or just cultural products. There was quite a lot on empathy and the idea that, you know, if you read more, you become more empathic and, you know, Obama is great because he reads a lot and that kind of stuff. And we still kind of believe that, but we're also entering a bit of a post empathy phase. And I mean, I have colleagues working on this in very in different fields, maybe specializing on the depiction of conflict, for example, or the depiction of violence. So I think there's some lesson to be learned there, the idea that we have the narrative. It's not very different from your work on narrative persuasion, I think. There are also risks in narratives. And once again, what we somehow trial in the safe space of fiction could then have an impact on the inclusion of narrative within discussions of ethical issues or public policy and so on. So I think now, I mean, I'm so glad to see the issue out there online first. Also because it is a bit of an experiment, actually. So if there is, at the moment, this new conjunction, this new collaboration between bioethics and medical humanities, well, we did even more. Like, you know, we triangulated the whole thing. We inserted the social scientists. It was a challenge, but I think, like, you know, it was, well, first of all, fun and possibly even helpful. I'll probably go back to my tweeting now, and happy to discuss more with you later.
Okay, so I guess I come at this from a slightly different perspective, right, which is that I have had a career that's not really been characterized by settling to anything. So although I identify primarily as a professor of ethics, I have a really unusual background in that I've come via lots of disciplines. So I started off in medicine, went to philosophy, went to law briefly, that was a mistake. Subsequently did a social science PhD, an empirical PhD, qualitative methodology, looking at constructions of what it was to be a good doctor, and then latterly have done master's work in theatre studies, drama. And because of that, what this all comes down to for me, and why this is relevant to the journal, because it's not just here's my story, is that I've been always really interested in ways of knowing, ways of approaching the same problem or question or phenomenon, but through different lenses. And the thing that has always struck me is whenever I've jumped to a new disciplinary pursuit, whatever that might be, I've had to, well, not I've had to, but there's almost a disciplinary pressure to unlearn what it is you've known before. And I'm both puzzled and appalled by that. And I suppose I've spent my career trying to find interdisciplinary relationships that are A, meaningful, and B, recognize those multiple ways of knowing. So it's a bit like a kaleidoscope. You shake it up and you see things differently. You see new patterns and you see it fresh. So when I heard about this issue, that interested me in itself, that it was going to be, I thought, interdisciplinary and looking at a big question, but in a very open-ended way. But there was another bit to it for me, which is that as well as my academic work, I have two other bits, really, of my life, and they're not unconnected. One is I spend a lot of time on the wards. So St. George's, for those of you that don't know, is a specialist health sciences institution. We share our site with the largest hospital in London. And I have two sessions a week that are clinical ethics sessions. So these are where you see the absolute translation, if you like, of all the theory that you think you know and all the pontificating you do comes tumbling down around you as you encounter real life. The other bit of my life that was interesting to me in this context is I've done a lot of broadcasting. I do a lot of work with theatre companies and a lot of what passes for public engagement activity. And those two things have really changed me and my approach to ethics and what I understand to be a moral problem, both in form and content. So I've become very interested in who gets to call what a moral problem is and what it's about. Related to that, I'm interested in the use of cases in clinical ethics, you know, the construction, or in ethics generally, the construction of a case is itself a moral act. You are making choices. You know, whose voice, whose point of view, who's silent, who's absent, who's the audience, what's the language, where are the adjectives, how's it, how are the people described? You're mediating what the problem is when you present a case. And medicine loves cases, you know, on the wards, that's what I get. I get told, you know, this is a 35-year-old woman who's refusing treatment, blah, blah, blah. And I always ask, always, what's this case about? And who decides? That's kind of what's at the bottom of it. The broadcasting work was about working with the BBC on a radio series that's run for 12 years now, called Inside the Ethics Committee. And when I was approached, I guess for me it was, there was lots that was appealing about it, but there was lots that was intimidating about it. I was suspicious, so I was interested in that suspicion. How could I be busy doing all this public engagement work and thinking ethics was the best thing in the world and doing all of that and yet not want to lift the veil? What was that about? Because I was anxious about it. I was interested in how they were going to construct and share the stories. And I learned tons. I cannot tell you how much I learned. And it completely altered over the years. So I was a program consultant, and I also appeared on it regularly. And it led to some spin-offs, which I presented. And we also wrote some dramas. So I really got to think about the way we tell stories about ethics. Both the content, so the way we tell stories about a specific issue, so an end-of-life choice or access to treatment or whatever it might be, but also how we tell stories about ethics itself and who gets to tell those stories. And so my paper, I guess, was the synthesis of years and years of thinking about this, but also living it. And what I did was step back a bit and really thought about two specific projects, but tried to think about them both in terms of form. So what did they look like? What did these acts themselves, so if you like the meta-narrative of Inside the Ethics Committee, both in terms of the program structure, but also other sorts of narrative approaches. So whose voices got heard? How did we decide whose voices got heard? Who participated? When did the conversations, how do we manage conversations ongoing? I got more correspondence than I've ever had in my life after taking part in Inside the Ethics Committee. I looked at the tweets that the social media interpretation, that's a really interesting bit of work. We all tell stories. We very rarely get to see how our storytelling has been received. It can be quite a painful, and you may need to brace yourself for that, but it's a valuable thing to do. So looked at the form, but also looked at the content, looked at the types of stories. And although there wasn't time here, this paper has been really helpful to me. I've loved writing it, and it's such a joy that it was published, really, because it's helped me think about what the tropes are in ethical storytelling. You know, we already talked about Arthur Frank's work, but actually the one thing Inside the Ethics Committee never did was it resisted the wish to impose order on chaos. It resisted the redemptive narrative arc. It was committed to, and I am going to put it in inverted commas, truth, which of course meant it was committed to there being no truth, it being committed to multiple perception. That was, for me, the closest it could get. And that's really rare. It wasn't expert-led. I was one of an equal group, and I talk quite a lot about what that is in the paper. The other project that I talk about is work with the Donmar Theatre that I did last spring. On a play called Elegy, which is the latest play by Nick Payne. Some of you will know it and know his work. And that's a slightly different thing, but it was presented to me as an ethical play, by which I think they meant that there was a sort of ethical dilemma at the heart of it. And that isn't really what I'm writing about or I'm that interested in. What I was interested in was drama, and particularly this play, which is a non-linear it's not exactly plot-free, but it's got quite a complex structure. It plays with time, it plays with form, it plays with tropes, I guess. It plays with typologies in the professions. The Doctor is a very interesting character in it. And what that might tell us, both about the specific issue in the play, but also the performative nature of ethics, the performative nature of decision making, of choices, apparent choices. And then running alongside this, that Omar has a program called Take the Stage, which is for kids who come. They have to come from one of three boroughs that are identified as being hard to reach groups in the language of the Arts Council. And so I went along and with theatre makers ran a workshop for 60 kids, none of whom had been to the Donmar before, and most of whom hadn't actually been into the West End before. They hadn't been to Central London, so they'd lived in London, but they'd lived in a very different version of London from that which was familiar to many people who would go to the Donmar. And why did that make me think? Well, these guys have never done an ethics seminar in their life. The language of ethics to them was not their language at all. And you probably wouldn't necessarily have described them as articulate in any conventional sense. They were not going to be able to construct a neat story with fluency and confidence. That was not their bag. But my goodness, they got ethics. They got ethics intuitively, and again in a way that made me think we're so missing the point so often in ethical teaching, practice, academia actually. I count myself as culpable amongst this. What do I mean by that? I'll give you an example. The play Elegy, that the work they do is always supposed to be around the play. It was about identity, really, I guess, one of the fundamental themes. And what they talked about was the moral choices that they make on a day-to-day basis as kids, often living in quite a difficult environment. So there was one in particular who stands in my mind who had a very difficult tension, as he experienced it, between his family, who are Jehovah's Witnesses, quite a strict family from West Africa, immigrant family who are not long in London. This is an alien environment. And he talked about what his identity meant and what it would mean if he were required to make a choice, and as many of you will know, where his health is determined because of his belief system, so reconciling belief systems. He didn't use the language of autonomy or cultural relativism. He didn't need to. And I have never heard that perspective, even in the most beautiful narrative ethics texts. They're still mediated. They're mediated by people like me in papers like this. And I guess for me, this is part academic thought, for want of a better way of putting it. But it's also a real plea to anybody in academia or thinking about going into this field to look beyond the credentialed, the expert, and to think about what you might do for trust in ethics and empowering people to engage with that if you looked at it in a slightly different way and worked, got out and did slightly different things with different groups of people. So it was partly analysis, but partly call to arms, actually. And on that note, if you're at all interested, at the Park Theatre next Wednesday, there is a play on called Killing Time, and that's been my latest theatre project. It's a play about end-of-life choices, I guess. And there's a free talk back event afterwards, which I'm doing. So get out there, meet proper people in Finsbury Park. See you there.
Thank you.
Is that right? I've been trained to project. I wondered how you thought of this as the theme for the issue, because I don't think I know.
Mark.
And I'd love to know.
Mark. We're recording. So if you don't want to be recorded, let me know. I should have said at the beginning. Not a pro. So I think what I was saying earlier, we didn't want to have a themed special issue. We thought we were going to have some mission on vaccination, climate change, or because, you know, this speaks to public trust and expert knowledge. But we thought if we have a themed issue, we're going to cut out lots of things that we want to be surprised. So it was more about methodology. You have to be narrative. So we got some mission that talked about public trust, but didn't have any narrative in it. I'm sorry. but it was, you know, it was a great journey just to see. We didn't expect gestational diabetes, for example. This was not something that I expected, but definitely. And in the end, there was quite a bit of epistemic injustice, at least in three papers. So Deborah's paper, Jordan, Jack, and Jennifer Edwell, and Daniel Buchmann, Anita Hall, and Daniel Goldberg on chronic pain, which is we didn't even mention epistemic injustice in the call for paper. So it was, you know, it was great to see that the question of public trust speak about power hierarchies and the production of knowledge and power structures in healthcare or beyond. So that's why. I had a question for Deborah. It was about your, you mentioned the West African kid and who was, you know, asking question about what you would do in relation to if you were in a situation with the Jehovah's Witness parents. So it didn't frame it in terms of autonomy or not at all, or in terms of the second thing. So how did he frame the question?
He didn't frame it as a question. What? So they were given a theatre exercise, not by me, but by the professional actors who are working with them. And what they had to do was improvise a scene that they dreaded happening, but they felt was really crucial potentially to their identity. And they did loads of things. An ethical scene. It wasn't just any old scene. That would have been far too risky. But what they did was, so we had vegetarians talking about being tempted by McDonald's. We had, we had all kinds of stuff that they perceived as moral. And went to them. There was a lot about faith. There was a lot about choices. There was a lot, as you'd expect from a group of adolescents, about peer pressure. But what he did was a brilliant, very funny, actually, mocked up. He played his mum. I have a very vivid impression of his mum at the end, and he showed me a picture, and I think it was pretty damn good. But she was quite an overbearing West African mum, you know, telling him that he was failing in many, many ways. And he played her, and then he played himself. He played with time, so they were in hospital, and then they were in his bedroom, and she was telling him to tidy up. And then I'm not doing it justice, but he acted it out. He acted it out. He performed it, and it was interesting because it came after we'd done some preliminary work on storytelling based on a young man actually that I'd met, a young teenage Jehovah's Witness, not having known there was anybody in the group at all of that faith, although why wouldn't there be? And we'd talked about this story to kind of get them used to me and who what I was and what I did and all that kind of stuff. And he very much, you know, people had spoken about, you know, that's mad, and why would a faith system make you choose between something that's healthy and something, you know, it's anti. You know, people had said some quite not poorly considered, but direct things, undoubtedly, and he just acted this out. You know, he'd not said a word. He'd not said a word in the whole ethical bit about teenagers who are Jehovah's Witnesses making choices. That didn't light his fire at all. What did was the role play, where he then mocked up, how would I explain to my mom that I'm going to go for a blood transfusion, and would my life be worth living? And that life worth living, if we're thinking about narrative, we all knew that there were so many levels on which he was talking about a life worth living in that context. You know, the literal, the metaphorical, the symbolic, the psychoanalytic, if you like, all of that was embedded in that life worth living phrase. But, you know, it wasn't an academic seminar, we didn't talk about that, but it has stayed with me.
Ken Plummer is really good here. He talks about the time and place for stories. So sometimes there's the kind of historical or a political context, political economy about being able to tell your story and find an audience for it. So it's only quite recently that child abuse stories have come to light and people are listening. So it's a historical shift. What are the kind of politics that need to go on for stories to be heard and for them to have proper impact? And I think that's part of what's going on, and Ken's great on that stuff.
Yeah, that really resonates with me. I think the whole sort of patient stories to boards of health trusts and things like that are well-intentioned but often missing the point because they're controlled and they're inherently mediated from the outset. I think that was one of the reasons that Inside the Ethics Committee was so revelatory to me. It wasn't unusual for the clinical team to hear during the making of the program something for the first time. And then the patient or the family would say, well, we have been saying that. And you'd think, well, it's not then about it being heard. It's about everybody was equal. You know, there was no, and that really mattered. It started with the patient or the family, if the patient had died, and we had a lot of cases where the patient had died, and the producers had an absolute commitment to that. There were anxious moments. There were moments where the producers would worry about, and this is a very interesting thing, this sort of protectionism that can kick in around the impact on the individuals of telling their story. And you know, you could be emotional, but not too emotional. It's a very ambivalent relationship, even in a very committed environment. I think verbatim theatre I've seen done brilliantly by its, you know, the clues in the name, the verbatim, you do get everything, including the ums, the ers, and I'm really interested in that for all kinds of ways. I think verbatim theatre would unlock and would allow for performance, but clearly getting money and the skills and everything else to do it, but it might it might be a way. Forum theatre is another thing that I've seen used very well to flip that dynamic. So for those of you that don't know, you perform it, or you get actors to perform it, depending on who wants to do what, but then you can pause it for the audience, and the audience are often the professionals in terms of the power, and they pause it to engage or ask questions, but it's owned by the performance in a different way, and there are other ways you can use it as well. I'd also look at something like the Hearing the Voice or Hearing project at Durham, and the reason I mention that is I think not only is it a really interesting project, it's on a very specific thing around reclaiming or challenging, I guess, constructions of voice hearing. It's a brilliant example of multidisciplinary work anyway, but actually it's also done masses to really, really properly think about things like powers and structures and form and what that might mean, not only to our understanding of what it is to hear voices or experience hearing voices, but who is the expert and all of those kinds of questions they have addressed in a way that I think is pretty rare. So it's a different thing, but it might be an exemplar. So I'll have a go, but anyone can. So I guess for me, if you think about even a really simple clinical consultation, you've got the quantitative, the qualitative, you've got the population, the individual, you've got the experiential, you've got the faith-based, you've got rational, you've got, we could go on with this list. You've got inductive, reductive knowledge, you've got existential questions, you've got very practical questions, you've got philosophical questions. You could spend hours just listing the types of knowledge or types of experience that are in the room. It's not surprising we don't understand each other and conflicts arise. And you see it in all kinds of interesting ways. Tiny things like, I've got a sore throat today, and the doctor just hears it's viral. They don't hear anything else. They may not know, you may never get, and you might have in your head, I'm, for whatever reason, my mother had throat cancer, or I don't know, I can't swallow, and there's something, there's all kinds of things playing out there. You may well be told, I can't see anything, the way, the seeing, the gaze, the Foucauldian gaze, if you like, delegitimizes immediately that sore throat. And so you can come out of that consultation, and the GP might think he or she's done a brilliant job of saying it's viral, you don't need antibiotics. And you're thinking, they didn't acknowledge my pain. They looked at my throat and told there was nothing. This is the worst sore throat I've ever had. I can't live my life. He doesn't know what he's talking about. I hate him. I'm not going to another doctor. You might not. You might be more rational than that. But you see what I mean? It's that kind of thing. And there's so much embedded within that, the sore throats, it sounds so simple, but there's so many choices being made. And some doctors in those circumstances might well choose to prescribe an antibiotic because they privilege the relational knowledge above the bacterial and viral debate. Some doctors will do a kind of fudge where they give you a prescription just in case, knowing full well that many people will go and get that dispensed. And they will do that because they think, the science really matters and I'd love to persuade you, but it's Friday, I'm going on leave and I want this relationship to work and I don't want a complaint and, my professional identity is important to me too. None of that said, but they're all ways of knowing about this sore throat And then I worked in Brunei for 6 months. You know, the concept of a sore throat was experienced entirely differently. I sat in on consultations where there was a conventionally trained doctor, as I understood it, and a specialist in Islamic medicine, and the ways of grappling with sore throats were completely different. And I, you know, again, it was a reminder to me that everything is culturally and socially situated, and even within that, it's minute by minute judgments are being made that are about ways of knowing. I'm going to shut up. I've said far too much.
Another way in is something I use is wind stuff about sheep farmers in Cumbria in the 80s. After Chernobyl, the cloud went over Cumbria and sheep farming had to change. So the scientists went in and said, oh, we've found radioactive stuff on all the grass. You need to cull and you need to manage your sheep differently. I know this is a long way from medicine, but ethnographically, the sheep farmers have very different ideas of how to look after their sheep. So reconciling what the experts were saying and what the farmers wanted to do and knew they could do in the pasture land they had and how they shared it between themselves and how sheep do stuff. So there are different ways of knowing that were playing out that had to come into contact for a sustainable approach to the minimisation of that risk. And prevailing mythologies about Cumbria, I understand, is close to Sellafield and 10, 20 years before there'd been a fire. So the epidemiologists didn't have that knowledge, but the farmers did, because they'd lived there that long. They remembered the fire and they weren't willing to just attribute the radioactivity to Chernobyl. They retained a sense in which they'd been exposed before anyway and survived. So I think there are resources in the field that help us to think through the kind of cultures of knowing and articulations of those.
Going to add something else about not knowing. So going back to epistemic injustice and the second type of, this epistemic injustice concept, which maybe, you know, something that we can all intuitively understand what it means. You know, so if you are discrediting certain types of people systematically from being producer of transmitters of knowledge, but it's something that now goes back to a book about 10 years ago now, Miranda Fricker. It's been applied in many contexts in medicine, and actually just I think I found that there is even a Routledge now anthologies on epistemic injustice in healthcare. So that means that, you know, it's really, if you have an anthology on the concept, it means that it's become legitimized. But it talks about two main kinds of injustice. One is a systematically discredit of individual groups from being producer of knowledge. And the second is a kind of hermeneutical injustice, more a priori, is when in a certain culture, you don't even have the concept to talk about something, so you don't have ways of knowing about something. And Fricker makes her example is rape or sexual harassment. If in a certain culture you don't even have can refer to that concept because it's not part of your culture, then you cannot tell other people that this is something that you've been through. And I was thinking, recently I was being a reviewer for a paper talking about qualitative studies in women in Nigeria about their reproductive autonomy. And of course, the study finds that these women do not think about their decision about reproductive autonomy, unsurprisingly, because in Nigeria, first, you don't even have, you cannot have not consensual sex within a marriage. So that's not even a concept. So how can you talk about reproductive autonomy? So for me, like reading the papers, I'm sending it back. You need to read something about hermeneutical injustice and then add it. Because, of course, it's not just, you know, it's about you don't even have a concept to talk about. That and it relates back to what Deborah was saying about, you know, different cultures and talking about illness in very different ways. And we have think mental health is another example. I have one colleague in our department, Orchide Behurozan, working on mental illness and in Iran and what it means to have mental illness. And so it can be understood in very different ways. So ways of knowing, but also of not knowing. So, more questions? Giulia.
To trustworthiness, is that relationship worth trusting? And that's something you've spoken about and that we noted in the introduction. So I think the kind of idea that trust is a kind of quality of the person, that they possess more or less trust in something, kind of just completely erases what you're talking about. It's about this kind of relationship that has to happen for something to happen, diagnosis or a treatment plan, or in research, you know, disclosure about sensitive issues, that all needs to happen because of trustworthiness. And I think that's a lot of the work on trust is just not really getting into that qualitative, relational, very hard, very slippery to research and, you know, think about. But that seems to me where the action is, and that's, I think, for me, narrative is about the teller and the listener. It's always about that relationship. And that's why I think narrative opens up trust. Because, you know, how a story is heard or read is the power of the story. And then, you know, how the participants are moved by telling and listening to that story is part of what's going on. So this is a bit random. And I think the other dimension, you know, trust doesn't have to be a cognitive exercise. In a sense, it might be a leap into not knowing, but trusting nevertheless. And that means there's an affective dimension, and thinking narratively helps us to think about how knowledge is transmitted with a whole package of meanings around feelings and morality and so on. I don't know if I've addressed your question.
I think it's a brilliant question, and I think ethical problems are often problems of trust in both directions. So the professionals, for all kinds of reasons, may not trust their patients or the families or each other, particularly within teams. And I suppose this for me is the link with public engagement, because public engagement is often offered as a sort of ethical panacea, that it will kind of, you know, give people the opportunity to hear from experts and hear from scientists and find out that they're normal people and human beings and all that kind of stuff. And I think it's, in my experience, it's so unimaginative and still so expert-led and still consists of, you know, I do quite a lot of sort of festivals and things, so ideas festivals, Hay Festival, things like that. It's still a kind of sage on the stage model, you know, wise person, clever person in conversation with other clever person. It's quite self-referential. Public engagement at my university, this has been recorded, but it tends to be, you know, coming in here from brilliant experts in our wonderful building. We don't even begin to think about what it might mean to have to cross the threshold to come into the building, you know, and what we might miss out on. It's very much about you come and learn about the clever stuff we do, rather than we might learn from you, our community in which we sit. I also want to put in a bid for a non-verbal narrative. So what I mean by all kinds of things, but so there's some brilliant work going on around frailty at the moment, which sounds unusual. And I now can't remember the name of the person, but I'm going to send the link to Sylvia so she can share it. But it's visual arts, basically. It's somebody who is using visual arts to capture frailty, what it is to be frail. And I defy anybody not to look at these. There's the sculptures, really. I think that's what you'd call them. I'm not sure. But not to look at these and get frailty in a new way or in a way that is never going to be yielded by reading the Journal of Aging ever. And, you know, I talked about form and content. I think I've got a bias towards theatre, but it can be music, it can be visual arts, it can be poetry, you know, whatever it is, that's another way of ways of knowing it. So I would suggest to everybody that if we really want this mutual relationship, then we have to start being more imaginative, and we can't say we want a dialogue and then shut it down or only want it on our terms. And that for me is the real challenge around public engagement.
Can I add something on the question of space? Because it sounds as if there is a bit of a spatial moment in the humanities, whatever that means, but the connection between trust and space and what we understand as space is becoming more and more relevant. I can share a personal experience. In December, I organized with my colleague Andrew Blades at Bristol a series of events around World AIDS Day. And we wanted this to be, we wanted public engagement. So we were in touch with this Bristol-based charity. We offered this graphic medicine, graphic narrative, graphic storytelling, comics making workshop to members of the charity. And the response on Twitter, the response on social media was great, and everyone was very enthusiastic about it. We had this great nurse turned into illustrator as the facilitator of the workshop, and then relatively small presence of people from the public on the day. And so we wanted to know a bit more about this, because apparently that was the way. So it's not as daunting as telling your own story in a very, like, you know, crafty, literary template. It's just comics. It's just, like, you know, playing a bit with four frames and telling a bit about your preoccupations and so on. And the question of space came up, the idea that, yes, it's great that you do this, but, you know, people with HIV/AIDS, stigmatized, history of prejudice, history of discrimination, you know, they don't feel like walking into, you know, a university classroom and do this. Maybe, you know, again, how do we build trust in the safety of our institutions? Maybe, I don't know, maybe we have to go outside of our institutions first, or maybe we should, I don't know, work towards a different perception of what happens in the academic environment. I mean, this was meant to be fun, and it was fun, but again, maybe for some patients, it was just too much, like it was overwhelming.
Project.
Enrico and Tommaso. So we'll take these three questions, then well, I think we'll close it. And but if you want to, so Rob.
Okay, so my question is simple, but maybe not necessarily easy to answer.
Okay.
I feel like I have to tell a particular kind of story, and it goes like, well, I'm learning all the time. So, of course, it's transforming. Yeah, I guess it's at a depth. I think this narrative thing is so big. You know, there are so many rooms to explore that it's very hard to reduce it. I mean, it just escapes one's ability to explain it and use it, and I think that's what's most interesting. And it's been a really satisfying process hearing Deborah talk about her work. She's doing the research that I wish I could do. This kind of public narratives and thinking ethically about those, and I've learned a lot from that process. So that's where I'm at, and I'm thinking, how do I take these ideas into the kind of next project, the next empirical project? And I think I might be a bit post-trust, not post-narrative, but, is this being recorded? Trust has emerged in discourse around Trumpism, so people not trusting government, so they're going to... And I was thinking maybe trust is something we need to get beyond, because people are using it in so many different ways.
That's good. I start from a very theoretical point of view, and of course the work I do on trust is of course textual, and in my research and with my students we constantly talk about the reliability of narrators and the trustworthiness and how do you build that, which are the clues in the text that are going to signal this is an unreliable narrator, this is a trustworthy narrator. To me it's always refreshing to see that all these very complicated debates we have in the classroom or with my colleagues and often over coffee actually have relevance in the real world. And this is actually linked to the idea of incorporating patient stories into policy and bioethical discussions. The use, for example, of forum, like patient forum, as we, as the authors of the paper on gestational diabetes did, is, yes, of course, a way of engaging with that kind of ongoing trust building in the text, which then has a relevance, a resonance in wider debates. So I wouldn't say that my understanding of trust has changed, but it's definitely, I have a better sense of where our concepts and our abstract thinking about narrative trust can lead. In the real world, as it was.
I think I have thought differently about trust, but maybe not in the way you mean, in that because of the way I work, and I'm usually very lucky in that I'm a tolerated trespasser in lots of different worlds. But there's also something about me not always trusting different disciplines to get it when I'm doing multidisciplinary stuff, and them not always necessarily trusting that I've got anything to add to the debate. And I guess, I mean, that's it doesn't change anything for me. It's a challenge, it's interesting. But why has this specifically changed? I suppose because it made me think how rare it is to submit an abstract like I did, which, you know, Sylvia very kindly described it as a surprise. I'm not quite sure that's what... I think euphemisms it may be at work here. You know, actually, it's kind of, oh, what the heck is she talking about? What, that's not what we had in mind. And that's not unusual. And I suppose it made me think about trust between with academic journals, trust the way academic journals trust editors, guest editors, and I edit a journal, so I can say this, that, you know, it's an act of trust when you hand over your journal to a bunch of guest editors. But the way that this team trusted me to produce something that was a bit left field, but also thinking about where I publish sometimes, where I choose to publish, and what I might be missing out on by assuming sometimes that certain disciplinary journals will be closed and others will be more open. And it did, it's that ways of knowing thing again, I'm afraid. It did make me think about academic trust of each other and the disciplines within which we work. And, you know, we talk tons about wanting to learn from each other, but it's not dissimilar to what you were saying. It's often on our own terms. What we actually want to do is say, well, I see it this way a lot, and not really engage properly. And this journal really made me, this paper really made me think about that. And I'm still thinking about it. And this seminar has made me think about it. So thank you, really.
Thank you. Briefly, definitely, if you talk about bioethics, there are many like ethical issues that you can see. Okay, in this paper, talk about refusal of vaccination, or talking about choosing an egg donor who looks like yourself. So you know, you can think about traditional ethical question: can it be ethically justifiable to choose an egg donor that looks like yourself? But that's like, if you read this paper, I found like myself thinking, that's just a stupid question. So there are many more interesting questions to ask about why do people want to choose donors that look like themselves? So other ways that bioethics should engage with this question, with the idea of what a race concept does in this decision, or how gender plays out, or beliefs. So it definitely led me to think more about beliefs. There was a discussion around epistemic injustice. I mean, vaccine refusals are not about science. It's people, how they construct a coherent system of belief, picking and choosing from people they trust. So it's fascinating to see how a construction of coherent system of belief is being formed and then informs ethical what we could consider ethical decisions. So definitely it's led me to question, certain ways of doing bioethical, asking just whether a certain practice should be ethically justifiable or not, because that doesn't lead you very far. But I think I'm going to talk more about that. So I had two, aware of time, so they may come here and shut us off. Tommaso, do you want to have the last word? Yeah. Who wants to go first? Mark.
No. The promise of neoliberalism. But the story's failed. Someone's told a story in the 80s about the magic of neoliberalism and marketism, but I think the generations that have endorsed that story have realised that hasn't delivered to them particularly en masse the promise, although they can see other people having it. So I think that might be what's going on. And I don't think it's about knowledge so much, but I think that class of people, the people who point at the despicables, are being kind of bracketed with that.
Sure.
I think it might be about not recognising that with any expertise usually comes status and privilege, although it ill behoves the person who made those comments to comment on status and privilege. But nonetheless, I think it is about epistemic labour and the division of that, but there's a whole bunch of stuff that comes with that, and we often don't attend to that stuff, and that might be why some people are throwing out the whole big picture. It's not the knowledge, it's the money, it's the power, it's the privilege, it's the assumption, it's the disconnect, it's the lack of commitment, it's all of that stuff. And that's a personal view rather than an academic view. Yeah.
I don't know, I just say something about the role of the media, and I think, going back to what we were talking about earlier, public engagement, sometimes, you know, we think that we're doing public engagement where you're just talking to people and just trying to explain our knowledge, maybe just if we are avoiding jargon, then we think, okay, I'm doing public engagement. But actually, it's much more than that. But we see it also in the way that academic knowledge gets out communicated to the media in that way, in the way that I was talking just now about a certain question, maybe the framing of the question. So we may be missing the point often. Deborah was talking about, you know, I wrote it down because she put it beautifully, what is a moral problem in form and content, and even not the construction of a case is a moral act. So we may be often missing the point, and hence disconnect, hence distrust, and then you have everything. You throw out the baby with the bathwater. Yes, thank you. So thank you very much for coming along and staying tonight. And yes, we close it here, but next Wednesday, if you want to hear more about theater and the Park Theater, and next Thursday, but unfortunately it's here, we're not going outside. We have a discussion in this room at 5 p.m. on another play, Deny, about gene doping and enhancement, with a play writer coming here, and we're going to read some scene and discuss it. Not as exciting as going to the theater, but second best. Okay, thank you, Mark, Deborah, Maria.